It's good to be back in the pulpit. I've missed it the past couple of weeks. We had a tough week in the hospital, but as you can see, Anna is here today and doing quite well considering. Still struggling with pain. Yeah, it's good to see Anna back and feeling better. But she's got some more surgeries coming up in a few weeks, and the good news is we're making progress there. And so continue to pray for her and pray for that journey. It's been a long one. But God's grace is in it, and His grace is sufficient. Last week, we also had a really nice time, Labor Day. We ended up getting away to Chicago as a family. Unfortunately, Anna went in to celebrate her birthday in the emergency room, so we wanted to go and have a night away together as a family. So I appreciate Jerry filling the pulpit for that time as well. If you haven't watched the news much over the past few weeks, there's been some interesting things that have happened across the country. That hurricane that came through on the West Coast caused some really strange weather. And sometimes I think we're going to pray for some of it coming up here at the end of service, but we miss over some of the things that happen. One of the benefits of being a pastor that's part of a region of churches, that's part of then a nation of churches, and really we have expressions of the faith all over the world, is I get to hear stories on the ground of what's happening. And that huge storm that came through the desert, and deserts are not used to having a lot of rain. One of the first things that happened is we see in Las Vegas, if you watched on the news at all, they had tremendous flash flooding. What the news doesn't often tell you is that the entire homeless population of Las Vegas lives in tunnels under the city. There are thousands of people, and there were casualties that we'll never really fully know the answer to because the rain came in hard and fast. And they have a neat system that diverts all of that rainwater, all that flash flooding back in to the reservoir because water is so scarce there. But what it meant is as those tunnels filled up in minutes that there was almost no way around the fact that there was a huge human loss, a huge casualty. And we're going to pray for those that are helping and those that were involved in all of that at the end of our service. The second thing that happened is that I guess this past week there was this few-week festival in the desert. They call it the playa there, called Burning Man. And most of the news you probably saw about it was making fun of those at Burning Man, having this festival, being in just this tremendous muddy crisis. In fact, they made it a state, tried to make it a national emergency to say that these people needed to shelter in place because they literally couldn't drive away. When they would walk, it looked like they were on stilts because of how much the mud it's an old dried lake bed, so when it rained, it just became this horrible mud. Now, there's a joke in our family. I've often said that I think Burning Man would be a fun thing to go to if it wasn't for all the people. Now, I'm sure the people is what makes Burning Man good for everyone, but it's all sorts of art and installation. It's these, I think, 3 weeks that an experimental city comes together. You can't buy anything, you can't sell anything, everything has to be given away. There's a lot of, I think, neat philosophical, social experiment happening there. But for me, there's too many kind of out there naked people to make it something that I would want to go to. But isn't that the thing about community? Like, you know what? Cities are great if it wasn't for all the people. Churches are great if it wasn't for all the people. We want community, we desire community, but at the same time, the thing that makes us apprehensive about joining a new group, about joining into community, is the fact that people inevitably bring conflict, and that conflict can be painful. Talk to people that desperately would love to be involved in another church again, but they can't get past the wound or the trauma they had at the hands of another church person. Maybe it was a church split. Maybe it was spiritual abuse where a pastor was harsh or really tough on them. Maybe it was just, you know, that high school-ish click thing that can happen in churches where you're not one of the cool people and you didn't want to be reminded of that anymore. But community is important. The Scriptures share with us how we're desperate, that we long for community, that we need it. But at the end of the day, as we put a group of people together, there is a strong likelihood that we hurt each other, that we do or we say the wrong things. You see, the idea of authentic community is far more than just appealing. It's vital. And there is evidence that today people are literally dying for the lack of true community and connection. I remember after I graduated high school in the early 2000s, social media just blew up. No one had ever heard of Facebook. I think before that there were a lot of little things. In fact, when I was in even junior high, we had the bulletin board system thing. It was all text-based, and we'd, you know, dial into our friend's house and his server and play text-based games or leave emails for each other. But for the most of us, the majority of us, it was MySpace and then Facebook is what everybody seemed to have. Today, if you talk to my kids, they don't want anything to do with Facebook because Facebook is the thing their grandparents are on, and it's not as cool anymore. But for our generation, we understand what Facebook is. We understand social media a little bit. And that blew up, and it blew up because there was a need that it attempted to meet. But it meant that need about as good as alcohol or drugs meet any real human need that we have. It may have scratched a surface itch, but clearly we see the results of it have not been that community, this authentic desire for community, is met. In fact, studies have come out to say that it's causing young women to have eating disorders. It's causing other forms of body dysmorphia. It's causing untold amounts of depression because all people tend to do on social media is share their best moments. And it's become the worst of community out there in front, accessible at all times. So social media is not the answer. It's not going to save the world. It's not going to help with the depression and the epidemic of suicide that young people today are having. But nonetheless, community is a need. In fact, Jesus says this in John 17, verse 21. I pray that they will all be one. And he's talking about believers now, the church, just as you and I are one. And this is a prayer to God the Father. So Jesus is saying, I pray that they all, the church, will be one, just as you, Jesus, to God the Father, are one. As you are in me, Father, and I am in you, and may they be in us, so that the world will believe that you sent me. Jesus' prayer. This is his prayer in the garden in Gethsemane. This is his final prayers to the Father before the cross, is that we would experience supernatural unity in community as we are in Christ and he is in us. That we may experience the type of unity the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit share. And listen carefully to this part. This is the part I think we miss. So that the world will believe that you sent me. Your church is all the time saying, I don't understand why we're not growing. I don't understand why the community isn't coming in, why we're not being the lighthouse that we want to be. But Jesus made it very clear in this prayer, if we want the world to believe that God sent Jesus, if we want the world to believe the message we have is true, that belief is rooted in the unity that we have. The world must see the fact, they must see us loving one another well. The world must see us caring for one another and united in community, and that will be so appealing because there's a need imprinted on our hearts that they will say, I want to be a part of that. I want to be a part of that. But if we miss out on this community part, if we don't do this well, if we don't love one another well, then the rest of the world's going to say, Their God can't be real. They don't even like each other. How can they love their God? So that the world may believe that you sent me. Our appeal to the world, the evidence of our faith, is rooted in truth. It's rooted in our ability to love one another supernaturally in community. Love one another in a way that only God can allow, that only God can make happen. But anytime I hear a story about the church on the news today, whether I'm in an airport or a hotel or even just at home with the news on, I feel like I'm getting ready for a body blow. Anytime I hear the name of a prominent church or a part of the evangelical community, because it's never good news. I mean, it's rarely, rarely good news. It's usually the story of a division, of a split, of a scandal, of abuse. That's how the world sees the church. That's how the media paints the church. Because if we really love one another, then the rest of the world will say, I want to be a part of that. Because there's such a deep need. And in today's scripture, it's not really about widows. Sure, that's in there. But Paul is giving us some very practical instructions on how we can love one another well. And I believe if we can follow these instructions, we can display love and unity in community with each other in a way that is attractive to all those on the outside looking in. If we learn to love each other well, then we will be asked to give a reason for the hope that we have. Then people will want to know how and why this is working when around the world and so many other places it's fake and it's phony. It's surface level. How do we love each other well? Well, it's only because of the sacrifice of Jesus. It's because of the Spirit of God that dwells in us. So the first thing that I want to look at today is that Paul talks about our need to respect generational differences. Verses 1 and 2, "Do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat younger men as brothers. Treat older women as mothers and younger women as sisters with absolute purity." It's a very unscientific breakdown of generations, breaking down people into groups based on their birth year. And the theory is that you can predict certain behaviors within generations because of the shared experiences they went through. So it's broken up this way. There's the silent generation. There are baby boomers. Then for those that are born around 1980, the millennials. Then you get into Generation X, then the millennials. Then Generation Z, which would be most of my children. And then Generation Alpha would be Jeffrey. He's like the oldest you can be for that next generation. And I'm sure you've heard some of the stereotypes. The silent generation kind of gets this kind of stoicism. They live through some really hard things, so they tend to be a little bit unmovable. Baby boomers are often, because of how large they are, they're considered to be that selfish kind of, I did it my way generation. Generation X is thought to be very independent. Millennials are said to be entitled. Generation Z, they're the indoor cats, the ones that need safe places, can't take the harsh reality of the world, they're somewhat sheltered. These are the stereotypes that if you watch CNN, if you watch the news, when they refer to these generations, they are emphasizing these things for each one. And then we don't know anything about Generation Alpha yet, we'll learn that as we go. But there are obvious problems. We look at generations just based on the worst traits we feel like they have. It mostly serves as a way to bring division between groups. In the family, in the workplace, in the church. Again, we say one group is lazy and entitled, the other group is responsible for. You watch news articles, and this is all day long. I see these things come up on my phone, on the TV, where millennials are blaming the boomers for them not being able to buy a house today, for the political decisions that have been made. You see expressions like, okay, boomer, a way to dismiss those who are older. You hear things about millennials, about how they want to work for like 45 minutes a day and then get their free lunch and breakfast and go home because of their desire for work-life balance. Again, it's only emphasizing the hardest and the worst and the stereotypes of each. But if we focus on those things, if that's how we see each other, then it's hard for us to have unity. And Paul says something very different. What does Paul say? He says that we are not supposed to look at each other in a lens of frustration. Instead, we're to look at each other through the lens of family. Tells us that we are to love our elders like they were our parents. And I love the fact here that he makes it very clear. He says, do not rebuke an older man harshly. I know there are some circles that believe that, you know, the elders could never be wrong. But Paul doesn't say that here. He's assuming that there will be times when the older generation makes a mistake and that there will be a need for some type of rebuke or confrontation. But he says, don't rebuke them harshly. Rebuke them like they were your own father, with love and care and compassion. And there will be inevitably times that the older generation needs to rebuke the younger. When we spend too much money on avocado toast. We do so as that we were rebuking our son with love and investment that they become the next generation. So the church is one of these beautiful places where generations have the opportunity to mingle. In the workplace, there's some of that, but we cut off the very young and the very old in that equation. It's only those who are of working years. But in the church, it's one of those few places where my kids have been blessed to have so many extra grandparents. I've loved to see the cards, even though I have to read the ones in cursive to my kids because I suppose the public education systems failed them there. They don't teach cursive anymore. But we read those notes to them and they encourage and appreciate all of that. It's in the church that we have the opportunity to connect with one another, but we have to see each other not through the lens of division, the way the world wants us to see each other, but through the lens of family and unity. Those who are the same age, we don't see as rivals. We see as brothers and sisters and men. As you see other women that are the same age in the church, they are sisters we look at with absolute purity. We will have different preferences. Generations always do. We might like different music. We might have different ways of doing things. We will sometimes annoy one another. We will frustrate each other. But if we remember that we are one family, and that we have so much more to offer each other than we do the frustration and division. See, if we become students, if we sit back, I have actually learned a lot from my daughters who are in a different generation. And on the surface, some of these new things, they feel silly to me. But I sit back and I listen and I learn. And there's something to it. And even if I don't like some of the attitudes that come out of their generation, or I don't like some of the preferences, we have to understand that they are the next generation. And if we don't take the time to invest in them. They will become far less of what we hope they become. We can't just stand back and say, ah, kids these days. And I'm not preaching that in a negative way to you guys, because this church has been a blessing to my family especially. But we live in a world, and again, I think this idea of how generations are used to stoke up anger and animosity, I think it's on purpose. I believe there's an enemy out there who wants us not to lean on each other, not to learn from each other. He wants the next generation not to receive the investment they so desperately need. Working through this college co-housing program, and it's amazing as I talk to some of the young people that even Ella knows that have never learned to balance a checkbook, that have never learned to make a meal. And it's not because their parents didn't care, it's because their parents don't know how to even cook a meal. They know how to go through a drive-thru or buy it from Uber Eats and have it delivered cold and at twice the price. If we break that down, if we don't invest in the next generation, it doesn't just get better. But the next generation is robbed of the opportunity to have their parents invest in them. So we have to get over all of the generational differences, and we have to learn to respect and learn and invest in each other. The second thing is we need to provide for those who are truly in need. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 4. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, these should learn first of all to put their religion into practice by caring for their own family and so repaying their parents and grandparents. For this is pleasing to God. The church as a community is a powerful force for social good. We bring together resources to accomplish and do more than any of us can do apart. And one of the earliest things the first generation church did was they learned to become a social safety net for those in need. And it was primarily widows, orphans, and those who were physically disabled. Those who are crippled. Now, the wonderful thing is a lot of them in the early church, we see this kind of age of miracles where Jesus not only was going around and healing those who are lame and crippled, but the disciples were going around. Remember, as the beggar came to James and John at the beautiful gate, he was asking for money, and they said, money I do not have, but what I do have is get up and be healed. And so there was a lot of that happening. But there was still a need to take care of widows, orphans, and some of those who had not yet been healed. And the church stepped in and they took this role on. There was no government doing. The Roman government could have cared less. But the church stepped in and began to meet the need. And the community around them saw that, and that was beautiful. But like any safety net, there were those who abused it. There were those who used it to accomplish what is maybe one of the greatest of human goals, but the most destructive, and that is the desire for more free time. Seems like much of what we do is motivated by this idea that it's better, the more free time we have, the better off we are. And we're going to learn in our next point that's not necessarily true. Because free time for many of the widows brought idleness, and it brought gossip, and that led to dissension and division and lots of problems. But for those who are truly in need, Paul first says that the church should have the Christians in their family take care of them. So Paul is saying that if you have a mom or a grandmother who is in need and you are in the church, if you are a believer, then your first duty and responsibility as a believer, putting your faith into practice, is trusting that God will provide for you as you provide for them. Paul's saying, don't burden the church. If you are a believer, don't step back and do nothing and say, oh, the church can take care of it. Paul's like, no. Put your faith into practice. This is what we do. In James, it says, what is true religion? It's keeping ourselves from being polluted by the world and taking care of the widows and the orphans. That's true religion. Now, religion and faith aren't exactly the same thing. Religion is what happens when we put our faith in practice, put that rubber to the road. And we serve in that way. It's part of the sacrifice. Tell you what, though, I have seen some of the biggest fights in church over money. One group raised money and another group spent some of that money to do the work of the gospel, and the other group says, nah, not a dime that I raised. Some of the nastiest moments, some of the nastiest fights were over how money was spent. And this was something Paul was dealing with in the early church. It was a big problem, and it was a big need, and the church was meeting that need. That's where we see the first deacons appointed. The first deacons weren't appointed because they needed help with music in church. They weren't appointed to help fix the building either, which is, I think, our biggest need for volunteers in the church today is, how do we keep this building from falling apart? Because it needs a lot. It's a lot of work. But back then, the first use of deacons, the first reason they were appointed was to help take care of the distribution list, of the taking care of the widows. So it was a big need, but early on we see there was grumbling, there was complaining, because as soon as one group got something, it was like, well, wait a minute, the lady down the street, the widow down the street, she got better stuff than my mom did. I want my mom taken care of better than the widow down the street. And it became this way to divide, as it was always being compared. It was never enough. So Paul says, first, if you're a believer, your mother or your mother-in-law is a widow or in need, put your faith in action. And second, he encourages the younger widows. He said, if you're a young widow, think about your desire to remarry before you essentially take a vow of celibacy and put yourself on that list. If you want a family again, think that through and maybe pursue that. Then finally, the church had the ability to meet those needs in a way no one else was. In a way that no one else was. And then finally we see Paul say that we must avoid idleness. Verse 13, besides, they get into the habit of being idle and going about from house to house. And not only do they become idlers, but they also become busybodies, and they talk nonsense, saying things they ought not to. Idleness gets all of us in trouble. This is not just a woman problem. This is not Paul beating up on the widows in the church, but he's saying that if we take all of the duties away, if we make that provision and all they have to do is sit around the house all day and sit around the home with no purpose, with no drive, then becoming a busybody, becoming idle is the next logical thing. It's what tends to happen, and it's not good for any of us. The goal of life is not to get to a place where we're not needed, where we have no purpose and only have an abundance of free time. The word retirement is nowhere in the scriptures. Leaders would be recommissioned to a new purpose, but the great leaders of the faith, they finish their job and Jesus brings them home. There is no, okay, now it's time to play golf 4 days of the week. And I'm not picking on any of you who play golf. Good for you. I'm terrible at it. But idleness gets us in trouble. You see, if we don't have an external battle to fight, if we don't have a purpose that we're striving for, if we don't have a mission, then what always happens is we turn and we fight with each other. If we aren't fighting the enemy, if we are not pushing back against the world, then we will find a way to fight each other. It was a beautiful thing when the church began to take care of the widows, but it was almost immediate that people were saying, well, again, my mom didn't get what his mom got. And I've seen it in practice in the homeless shelters. You can take someone that's off the street, that had no place to sleep, and you can give them a hot shower, and you can give them a hot and wonderful, nutritious meal, and you can let them get cleaned up and give them a bunk for the night and give them new clothes to wear, and you will see one man look at another man and say, well, I like his shirt better than my shirt. They came in there with nothing. And they were given so much, but yet we still find ways, if we're focused on the internal things, if we're focused on consumerism and what I want and what I need, it's never going to be enough because we will always have unmet desires. Even if we went from being destitute to being well-fed. It'll go from, I know we've got the ladies that work at our ladies and men that work at the mission house. It's frustrating to give somebody a bag of groceries, and most of the people there, I'm sure, are amazing. But I've been in situations where you hand out a bag of groceries and you see somebody that says they're very, very hungry begin picking through, like, oh, I don't know that I like this. I don't want to eat that. You guys got any, like, anything better than this? You know, you got, what else you got? It's like, if you're hungry and we put food before you, and I'm not saying that we want to put junk and say we don't care about any of the preferences, but when we are internally focused and when we have enough time, all we begin to focus on is what we want that we don't have. And we begin to look at other people who have the things that we want. And it brings quarrel and it brings conflict. And it's not the way that God designed the church to operate. See, we are called to have a common purpose. And this, church, I want you to hear, because I think this is an important and sobering thought. We have to ask ourselves, and I think we've got some good answers, but what is our mission and purpose in the community? Maybe a better way to say it is, if we invite someone new into our family, what are we asking them to join into? Is it supporting the fact that we have an affordable daycare that reaches out to the community? Is it the mission house that we use to feed the community? I think those are great answers. Those are ways in which we're serving out the mission of the church. Is it that we want to embrace the local schools and we want to breathe into the life of these children and help them to know Christ and to grow in a safe environment? I think those are great things. But if we're honest, and if I were to go around our region today, and if I were to go to some of these small churches that have big buildings like we do, if we were being honest, we would say, we want to invite them into helping us pay for this big building. And that's not the answer I think any of us want it to be. What are we inviting people in for? And we have this unfortunate consumerism in church today. When I talk to people who are unchurched that are looking for churches, maybe they're transplants into the community, one of the first things that I hear them say is, well, I want a church that can meet my family's needs. Fair enough. But what God wants us to do is ask the question, where is a church that has needs that I can meet? And it's not the need of opening my pocketbook and paying for the building. It's who has ministries and vision and passion to meet the needs of the community, to do the work of the kingdom that I can align with, where I can serve. Because God isn't calling us to come in and be served. He's calling us into the family so that we can go out and not be idle, but to use the gifts that He has given us to join with the purpose and mission that He's already doing to reach out and make disciples in the community. What we call people to is what we call people for. And much of today's strategy of church growth is how can we give lots of fun things that appeal to what somebody wants? How could I have better coffee in the morning? How can our music sound professional and even better than it does? Can we put some dramas on the stage? Can we make church more entertaining than television? More entertaining than what I could do at home on the internet? Playing video games. Well, it's become this race to who can be the most fun. And I fear at the end of that, we're just going to throw a circus. You'll see elephants and cotton candy and popcorn. But with how diverse things are, we'll never find a way to make it more fun for everyone. That's a losing battle. Instead, God is calling us to have authentic and deep supernatural community. He's calling us to be a place that loves each other so much, that loves each other unconditionally, that is there to bear one another's burdens, not carry somebody else's daily load, but to bear that overburden together. He's calling us to love each other in a way that the world will look at and say, wow, I have not seen that love. I've heard about it. I've longed for it. I've desired that community, but I haven't seen it. And so they become and say, what can I do to have what you have? Will you join with us as we serve and live out the mission of the gospel in our community? That's how we grow. We grow by loving each other and inviting others into that family. But as we do so, we have to be careful that our purpose isn't to say, sit in the pews and have all your needs met and just be served. We're inviting them in to serve with us. As we lived out at Colony Bay, Beth and I were trying to love and serve the community, but we had limited time. I mean, we were doing all of this as just kind of really trying to live out the Great Commission that I believe doesn't say go, but it says while you're already going, do these things. Go and make disciples of all nations, teaching them to obey everything I have commanded. One of the things that Beth did as part of her ministry is she had moms that she was connecting with, and they would want to spend some time with her, and she said, well, why don't you come to the grocery store with me? I'm already going to be going out and doing that, and you can tag along. And in doing so, it was amazing how they learned, like, how to grocery shop. Many of these families were on food stamps and had never really budgeted, because if you didn't know, if you have a large family, food stamps is like way more than most families have for money, for food. You'd see families with $980 in food stamps. And they never thought about how they would be economical or meal plan or do any of that. And so this while you're going happens. And you end up calling them in to the way that you live and the way that we serve and the way that we love. But it's not so that they can sit and be comfortable. It's so that they can belong and serve with us, and not just to pay for the building, but to live out the mission of Jesus in the community. And we already have a couple of great ways we do that, but I believe that God will be giving us more ways we can impact the schools, more ways we can impact our neighborhood, so that we can show them the love we have for each other. But it begins with the love that we have for each other. Worship team, if you can come forward. It's easy to preach a sermon about loving each other without the accountability of asking the question, is there anybody in the body, is there anybody in the church that you have a problem with? Is there anyone right now that you can say, oh, I love everybody but them? If that is true of you today, then God calls us to do two things. He calls us first to lay down our gift at the altar. If we have a problem with our brother in the church, the scriptures make it clear that we don't even make that sacrifice at the altar. But we lay that down and we go to our brother and we confess our sin and we repent and we forgive and we embrace. We love one another. And then we go to the altar and we worship together. Maybe you don't have the opportunity today to walk up to that person, but if you have a grudge in your heart, if you have bitterness towards anyone in this room or in the church universal, in the church globally, in a different building, in a different place, maybe it's a brother or sister or mother, maybe they've already gone home to Jesus, then we need to take a moment as we engage in worship in this song and say, I'm going to leave my gift at the altar and God, I forgive them. And then we can come back and worship freely. So if that's you, if God is putting a name on your heart, all you have to do is release it and say, God, I forgive them. And just like other situations in scriptures, I think we say, Lord, I forgive them. Lord, help me with my unforgiveness. I'm declaring it today, but I realize I'm going to need your help to continue to forgive moving forward. Let's worship together.